Amazing to me, living in Valparaiso, which, as we all know, is the belly button of the world. That's not what everybody there thinks it is. But you know, every one of our places is the center of everything. That's what we just got done talking about. You know, for a moment, this place is the whole schmear. And sometimes it can be the whole schmear so much that you don't want to go anywhere else. And think of all the other people out there who don't want to go anywhere and are missing this, you see. Well, there's always something to miss. And it would be sheer chaos if everybody got up and went somewhere simultaneously. I think we're on the verge of pulling that sort of business, but you know, you can't go anywhere in the world without meeting somebody that you knew 5 years ago. I'm in the middle of one of the most remotest parts of Africa, in the northeast corner of Uganda. That is where the Eeks are. Have you been reading about the Eek people who in two generations have had all sentiment and affection bred out of them? Little children of three are put out of the house to fend for themselves. 3 years old. So they go around and look at old people that can't protect themselves. One kid will open the guy's mouth and the other will take the food out and take it away from him. It's that kind of thing. We were up there and met a student of mine from 5 years previous who was working on a doctoral dissertation. Out in the middle, you know, what's a nice guy like you doing in a wonderful place like this? So you got to be careful about the romance, I suppose, of just getting up and going for its own sake. But I suppose what Holden suggests, and what I would sort of opt for, is that people forget about retirement altogether, do whatever it is they've got to do or have been looking forward to for their whole lives, have been saving up to do, and do it now. There's an incredible amount of stuff that needs to be done by people that can't be done when all of their energies are kaput, you know? And when the time comes when you retire and the world begins to owe you a living, it's more comfortable to sit. Just sit and wait around. Lord knows what for, but just wait. Wait for the grandchildren to come, you know, so that you can mess around and with them and live your whole youth over again. But a constant kind of waiting, and I sort of opt for suggesting that there's just no real good reason to do that. And of course there are. I mean, I speak like a real fool, because there are fiscal reasons, scheduling reasons, all kinds of reasons, but I'm showing you Africa as a way of telling you that we've all got those reasons, and that at least for one family, we chuck them all in favor of this, and we have never regretted it. It was the year of Cambodia and Kent State. Most of you are acquainted with what that was like. Some of you are acquainted with what that was like on a university campus situation, and I don't think any campus was exempt. If it was, it should have been ashamed of itself. It wasn't in the world. It was so intense. And good centers of Christian learning like Valparaiso University wound up with their administration buildings being burned out, with people terrified to go and live in a dormitory, and so they go over to the professor's house, you know, 18 the first night, 24 the second night, and six of them never did go back to school, you know, just spent the rest of the semester, you know, down in the basement, coming and going, but sort of having a home, so they wouldn't have to go back to a dormitory built in the style of 19th century American penal. It's a rather terrifying thing when you really need somebody to share your anxiety. So that year was a year in which I personally just lost all contact with the family. And the family was in the house, and most of the people in our house for a half a year weren't our family. You never knew who you were going to sit down with. Kind of like that anyway. You know, I go to the table and there are three kids there, and they're not mine. And all my kids are over at somebody else's. I think maybe we learned swapping, families from our children. Well, the idea, though, was that I looked around and saw strangers like my boy David, and I didn't know what had happened. And Liz and I were beginning to address each other as occupants. The kids called me Uncle Dad. And it was time to share something for a while, and after I don't know how many years it was at that time, 13, I guess, years at a university, there's no way that you can get away just by going home. Not while you've got telephones, not while you are within walking distance, not while you've got students around that would just like to come over and chat, or watch you paint, or pass the time of day. I mean, it's fantastic, but it is not a way of separating yourself. It just isn't possible. So when you cut the umbilical cord that ties you to that kind of mother university, and there is a comfort about being at a university, whether you're faculty or a student, it is a safe, relatively safe kind of place. When you cut it, you gotta cut it big and float free of it. So we decided to pick a place that nobody in our family knew anything about. Don't go back to Germany. Please, Dad, don't go back to Germany and then take us through all the museums and churches and listen to Bach for a year and a half. Come on. I mean, is there something maybe you don't know anything about, and Mom doesn't either, and we don't either, that we can all find out about together so that our reactions are going to be as legitimate as yours? And we couldn't think of we couldn't really think of a place. We read a lot, and we all have our preferences. But I finally went down to the travel agent and I said, "What's the farthest place away from Valparaiso you can go?" That was the plan. And she looked it up in her enormous book and said, "Well, there are a bunch of people that go all the way around the world. Let's pick one, TWA." We picked TWA, and in TWA's itinerary, it showed that they go to Uganda. I had never heard of Uganda, but that for only $50 more on each ticket, they'll take you all the way around. So in other words, Uganda was as far as you could go. Any further and you were coming back. That was where we would go. We said, "Okay, we'll go to Uganda," and then we started reading up about it. And she was preparing the tickets for Liz and myself and for the four children. Matthew, who at the time, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Dave, was, I think, 3. Dave had his 12th birthday coming back from Africa, across the international date line, and had one birthday in Kyoto and another whole birthday in Hawaii. Which was, becoming 12 with a vengeance. Kathy should have been around 9, and Matt, Michael,
should have been about 5 or 6. And that was the fan. And I guess we describe the family and try and say, wouldn't it have been neater if, you know, wouldn't you have been a little bit more freed up if you could have left the kids with the grandparents and just gone off by yourself? And the answer is an absolute and very affirmative no. There were things we were able to see because of the children that we couldn't have seen. There were people we met because the children had struck up relationships that we were afraid to make. And so we got to meet a lot of beautiful people that way. And also they came in handy at the customs station because they felt sorry for us. They figured most of that luggage was not contraband, but dirty stuff, you know. And we were trying desperately to get it to a washing machine somewhere. I don't think that we had any hassles anywhere. I mean, we would meet people, we would be in line behind people, and the guys would just be rummaging through all kinds, pulling out things and saying, what's this, what's that? And we'd come along, and one of the kids, we'd say, and they get fidgety and they start climbing up and down, and you know, and the poor customs people don't want to bother with all that. But the children are. If you got them, don't worry about how old they are. Just take them along. Kathy was born in Germany, and we went on a long excursion when she was 3 months old, just carrying her in a box. Seriously, and I think David, as a child, has gone to the bathroom on. Not at, but on some of the most important monuments in Western Even with the bloody coup that happened while we were there, there was an overthrow of the regime and a lot of rifle fire and bombing. And we talk about that now. We didn't talk about it much then, but now we talk about it as an adventure, as a real adventure that we all share. And it's not just a sense of pride, but it's a sense of having grown up together. I hope that eventually our kids will not be afraid of any stranger. And I think they're very close to being that. And I'm not that way. I don't like strangers. So I think the child is at least in process and well on the road to becoming father of the man. And I cannot think of a better way of doing this. Of taking your sabbatical or whatever. This was not a sabbatical. This was not a leave of absence. This was not a grant. I had no grant of any kind. We knew nobody in Uganda. I was not given permission to go. I just simply said, I'll see you, and if when I'm done with this whole thing you want me back, I'll be happy to come back, and if not, I'll find something else. No money, no income at all, and it was a matter of hocking your dirty socks in order to to make it go, because the travel, the airline tickets alone came to over $5,000. And for a university professor, that's a lot.
Because we were going around the world, decided to take 2 months getting there and 2 months getting back, and I'm not going to show you any of that. We wanted to be able to live in one country long enough so that we could identify with people and try and learn as much about it as possible. So we wanted to be there, you know, 9 months to a year, but we wanted to travel, so we did a lot of camping, and the tour saw us, just us, nobody else, but it saw us on the way, going to southern Spain, Morocco. This was mostly by camping, actually, down to Marrakesh and Fez and Meknes and Casablanca, and then up to Madrid and then up to Paris and through the Castle country of the Loire, over to Germany where Kathy was born, visiting some very, very distant relatives, and down to Italy, Switzerland and Italy, and then over to Greece, and then from Greece through the Aegean up to Istanbul, and then back down to Athens, over to Olympia for a couple of days of rest and recuperation, and then the flight from Athens to Kampala. And this is Kampala, the capital city of Uganda. Uganda or Kampala and its sister city Entebbe are right on the equator. I mean, right smack on it, except that they're 4,000 feet up. And that makes a tremendous difference. Lake Victoria is right here, the second largest inland lake in the world, or is it tomorrow? I think it's the second largest. So you've got a lot of interesting sky. Hemingway, I think, wrote about African sky, and that it's just absolutely endless and always changing, and he's right. Kampala is a British city. This was a British protectorate not all that long ago. You got to realize Uganda wasn't even known as a place until the beginning of our century. Some of you may have had an opportunity to see The Discovery of the Source of the Nile, that series on TV. This is where that the source of the Nile is. Yeah, always, everywhere. If it isn't Esso, it's Shell. A lot of people, like this particular fellow, cripples. They had a horrible polio epidemic not long ago, or by epidemic standards, and a lot of the results of that are still in evidence. Our market, where we got vegetables, the cost of living in Uganda was about the same as it is here, which I was very surprised about. I live off the land, but you can't. First of all, there is no middle class, and we're middle class. There is no middle class in Uganda. You are either a member of the government, and that means you've got a source of income which is bottomless. You've always got something to draw on. Or you are living on a non-cash economy. 60% of Uganda is still bartered, mostly with bananas, sometimes with cattle. We couldn't live like that. We didn't have bananas or cattle. And so we had to live on the wealthy classes' conditions, and it was unbelievable. When we got there, we discovered that a three-bedroom apartment with no furnishing and not including utilities could cost us as much as $900 American a month. The cheapest thing was around $450, which was like, dirt floors and little lizards all over. Well, there were little lizards all over anyway.
no matter how much. But the economy was, meat was cheap, which was really a strange thing to me, except it was a bit stringy because cattle are a sign of wealth. And so it took a couple years extra to persuade a man to get rid of his cattle, and by that time it wasn't worth eating. So you ate a lot of vegetables and fruits, that kind of thing. Unless you had an American throat and needed your post toasties, which cost $1.50 a box. And of course it came down from England around the, around the Cape, over to Mombasa, 900 miles inland, where land locked in Uganda. And by the time your post toasties arrive, they're not really fit for consumption either. So you tried to make do with what they had. The staple of the country is matoke. Matoke is a banana. It's a little hard green thing. And they would, I think that this thing to do is focus. I'm sorry, you'll just kind of have to squint. They steam a banana, or a pile of bananas, all day long, until it gets to be a mash. And there's nothing quite as filling and non-nutritional as a pile of mashed steamed bananas. There's nothing there, you know. I mean, it's like eating library paste. So they doll it up a little. And in some tribes, we'll doll it up with groundnut sauce, which is a reddish peanut sauce, and you get a little protein. And others, on particularly festive occasions, will put a sauce of henchwa on the top. That's termites. And termites are, they don't taste bad. It's kind of like eating candle wax. The wings keep getting caught in your teeth, but other than that. When I got there, I contacted the university, the only university in Uganda, and said I would be very happy to teach if you can use somebody. They have an art school, Chwala School of Art, Makerere University, Kampala. And they were very happy to do that. And it was a volunteer thing. There was no contract or pay involved. And they gave me the freshman class, which isn't exactly what I wanted on account of I was interested in doing some painting. But it was a beautiful experience. Now, Uganda is, we've been to an awful lot of places, and Uganda is, for me, the most beautiful place I've ever been in. They don't have hot season, cold season, wet season, dry season. They have red season, purple season, yellow season, white season. And it just rotates. You just wake up one morning and everything's red. Go to sleep and wake up on another morning. The acacia trees are out and everything's yellow. Then come the bougainvillea, then come the flame trees, then, you know, and it's just an incredible panoply of color. These are things in the university campus. This is where we stayed, and at least my volunteer teaching got us a place to stay, which was really lovely. It's the top corner apartment up there, three bedrooms and two baths, and it cost $250 a month, but they gave us everything we needed. I mean, knives, forks, an iron. The place was totally equipped and very, very comfortable. That's out the back porch. On a typical day, you never saw so many rainbows in your life. And more often than not, they come in pairs with the end of the winter of another one. That's Mulago Hospital. The first day we arrived in Uganda, I went over to the hospital. Somebody met us. We arranged we met at the plane by a friend of a friend. And they met us at the plane, and he had an appointment at the hospital, so I just tagged along. And we opted, or firmly decided at that particular moment, that for the rest of the year we would not get sick. I didn't want to hear anybody sniffle. I don't even want splinters. Nothing like that. And the hospital was so incredible. But guys in waiting, you know, like what you go fishing in. Orderlies in waiting booths with mops and gore all over, you know, just slopping up and down all over. It was like something out of Bruegel or, you know, just boom. Hieronymus Bosch, you know, here comes the old bloody hairy. And so I said, that's it. We are not going there. And that's the way the Africans feel about it, too. They don't go there unless they know that they're going to die. Really, they do not go there to get well. They go there to die. And as a result, you will see in the villages people living under the most incredible situations of pain and so forth. Jean and I were talking about her with her situation in Ethiopia and me with the situation in Uganda. One-sixth of all of the money spent on medical care in Uganda is poured into that building, that white building. One-sixth. As a result, the people in the bush have absolutely no access to medical assistance whatsoever. And it's a frightening situation. That's the art school. It was here that I found out about colonialism. I hadn't known too much about colonialism before, but I sure found out about it here. Uganda is East Africa. East Africa is not sedentary. It is always on the move. It's the herders, you know, like the Maasai people, the big cattle herders that move from one patch of green to another. But they don't stop and build monumental cities. As a result, they don't really develop a monumental culture. They have to have that portable thing, you know, like we were talking about last week, for those of you that were here. And they did beautiful, beautiful things. Their word for art means, translated into English, does it work? And which is, wow, a whole new thing for me. I hadn't realized that you could have, well, I was always separating things into either art or craft, you know, and craft was some sort of secondary thing. But for them, art was, does it work? And it had to not just work like hold things and be able to carry things or sleep on things, it also had to have a beauty about it. It didn't work if it held something but was ugly. But that whole concept was so strange and exciting to me. And then when I got to the art school, I found that in order to be an artist in this school, you had to either learn painting or sculpture or printmaking. And that was it. There was no craft at all. And then the British wondered why all the crafts were dying out. There was not even a course taught on the heritage of African art. And every single one of the professors was a graduate of SLAVE, which is the Royal Academy of Art in London. Every one of them, and only one of them was African. And it was so bad, it was so really rotten, I thought, and it was kind of nice not having a salary. You can just shoot off your mouth. What are you gonna do, fire me? So I got all my freshmen, and we started a course in African art, and they taught it. The freshman students taught Africa. I mean, it was, you see, I'm just off the boat and I'm going to teach a course in African art. So they taught it. What does your grandmother do? You know, what is your these kids came from all over the place, and they knew what art was. And so they taught the courses in African art via a kind of seminar roundtable discussion. And by the time the one semester was over, we had about 300 students in the commons room, you know, listening to people talk about how it was like. You know, and it was a scary, sad kind of thing. Everybody ordered their art supplies from London. Everybody. And I can see somebody's old grandmother sitting in her shambo waiting for her reeds to come from London so she can weave her basket, you know. It's just, you know, no way. No way. So they became dependent on a whole system which was not theirs. And so the next thing we did was see if we couldn't find ways of making art out of what was available to us. And I am not a Boy Scout, and I've got serious reservations about that whole thing. And I am not a woodsy type person. So all these guys and gals led me out into the woods, and we started picking up roots and berries and seeing what color they would make. I was intrigued by the Africans' excitement about when they would squash beetles and compare the various colors. Alizarin crimson. They were so excited about color, you know, it was just, we had a little celebration, clear a place, boy, somebody's gonna dance about alizarin crimson. Sing a beautiful song, cobalt blue. Right on the spot, kind of excitement. And I can just imagine some student back in the Palace of Art over here saying, Winsor Newton, cobalt blue number 2D. No way! It's just not possible. But they were getting kind of excited about it. The colors, and for myself, it was not a make-do thing at all. I came back with a couple hundred pieces of my own work, and when I checked it out, you saw some of my paintings pre-Africa, the descent from the cross thing, and it was a very gray thing. The colors since then have just become fluorescent, just shooting pinks and lavenders and purples all over. The children went to school, in an African school. In Uganda, the language, the national language is English. They fix that too. It was very convenient. But we had prepared to learn to speak Swahili. We figured if we're going to Africa, we'll speak Swahili. And we wound up in the wrong tribe altogether. And it was the Buganda tribe, and they don't speak Swahili. In fact, they get mad if you speak Swahili. And you don't want to make the Buganda mad, so you speak Luganda. And so the kids learned from our house girl how to speak. I would just like to say something in it to you, just to give you an idea of what conversation is like. In the morning when you get up and you meet somebody, if it's before 10 o'clock, there is a way of addressing someone. And it's, Osibiwa Tiana, which simply means, how are you? It sure sounds better. And the person will reply, And then that person will say, oh no, I'm sorry, they rushed it. What the person will reply, And then the first person will say, boom, which means, that's good. Can mean a whole lot of things depending upon how you say it. If you say, that means, I'm all right. If you say, that means, I'm not quite sure. And sometimes you can say, which means, I wish you hadn't been back. That one phrase was a way of
having conversations with people you didn't know what in the world they were talking about, but you would just go, And people were really, you know, they thought, wow, this guy, you know, came all this way, he's already into our language. But then after someone would say, then the first person would say, that means, that's good. And then the second person would say, or if it was after 10 o'clock, And then the first person would say, the second person would say, Well, this is a long thing, you know, for saying, morning. And so it was really neat. Going down the streets of Kampala, and you pass somebody, and he was going, He had met somebody. Started the conversation, but he was on his way to work, and we, you know, I'm sorry, I can't stop. But they would not stop that greeting. They just carried it on down the street past each other, and they were just finishing it, you know, which is really neat. If you saw somebody doing a good job, you didn't know them. You know, you were walking along the highway, and somebody was cutting the grass to keep the highway sides nice and neat. You would say, wave ladybug. Wave ladybug. Which just means thank you very much. And it was amazing, strangers thanking strangers for doing a good job. You'd walk into the apartment and there was a man just trimming, or a lady, a house girl who was hanging out the wash, and you would say, it wasn't your wash. You would say, wave ladybug. Which means thank you for doing your job. Bats, the barber shop, the House of Parliament, the entrance to the King's Palace. Uh-oh, I got a stuck slide. Well, I think we ought to continue this sometime. And tell you, like, I don't want to show you animal pictures and things like that. You know what animals look like. But the idea of living in a context which is earthly, which is honest, and which is new, makes you dissatisfied enough when you come home and see what you have been accustomed to. Not to get sad about what you left, but to make changes which you think are appropriate. Changes in your own lifestyle. Our kids are not so gung-ho on Christmas anymore. It's just kind of good. All this gimme this, gimme that. They make it. They make it. And it's beautiful. A whole lifestyle change. And if you can do that now, get up and go now. Learn some things now so that you can be learning things together and so that you've still got the energy to do it. It's an exciting thing. It's an adventure. And the money thing? Not to worry. That sounds terribly foolish, but I can give you a budget sheet and the whole schmear. And we're still paying for it. But we're also planning on going to the radio. Thank you.